Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're delighted to have District Judge Springmont sitting with us today. Thank you very much. Our first case for argument this morning is Catalan against RBC Mortgage. Mr. Keel.
Thank you. Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. Keith Keel on behalf of the appellants, Saw Catalan and Mia Morris. Plaintiffs filed this case alleging four claims: violations of RESPA, breach of contract, gross negligence, and willful wanton conduct against two mortgage servicers, RBC and GMACM. Judge Lindberg granted summary judgment in its entirety based upon GMACM's motion for summary judgment, and the case went to trial against RBC, resulting in a verdict for plaintiff. This appeal involves only GMACM. Now, in reviewing the briefs, it's apparent that many facts are in dispute. Yet certain key facts based upon GMACM's own documents should not be in dispute. For example, GMACM's customer service log shows that on September 9, 2004, HUD contacted it to explain there was problems with the RBC loan and that plaintiff had proof of their payments prior to the loan being transferred from RBC to GMACM. It's also undisputed that GMACM received on October 14th of the same year a letter titled Payment Dispute. It answered within 7 days in its own letter titled Payment Dispute. It's also not disputed that shortly before it answered this letter on October 15th of 2004, it sent a generic default letter to plaintiffs. This letter stated that if plaintiffs paid $9,588 and some change within 30 days, it would cure any default of their mortgage. It's undisputed that plaintiffs sent within that time frame a check for $11,186, but it's also not disputed that this check was never cashed. The loan was never cured until months later. Instead, GMACM sent the funds back. Several days later, they filed a foreclosure. Now, it's also not disputed that plaintiffs never bounced a check to either RBC or GMACM. You may have noticed in the response brief several instances of this being alleged. What GMACM might be referring to is in the summer of 2004, RBC had about 8 or 9 checks from plaintiffs they were holding in a suspense account. They cashed them without notice, and 2 checks were reprocessed within a couple days. No check was ever returned. No check was ever sent back for non-sufficient payment. And this has nothing to do with GMACM either. Not a single check written to GMACM was ever reprocessed, let alone bounced. Now, it appears the theme of the servicer's response brief is, so what? It eventually corrected the errors. It dismissed the foreclosure. 6 months later, it fixed the credit reporting. So what? It accuses plaintiffs of melodrama. Apparently, filing a wrongful foreclosure is not a big deal to the bank. In plaintiff's life, it was a big deal. And in making these arguments, GMACM blames RBC. It blames the plaintiffs for not writing better letters, for not being more articulate in explaining the months and months of errors that RBC caused. We submit that even though the servicer inherited a loan that had lots of problems and was mismanaged by the prior servicer, they had an obligation to properly service that. They had an obligation to investigate plaintiffs' complaints and determine and correct the account. We're not here complaining about RBC's mistakes. We're complaining about GMACM's actions. One, it admits we're wrong, that they had to correct. Turning to plaintiff's RESPA claim, the trial court never analyzed whether GMACM complied with RESPA. Instead, it found that it complied with the safe harbor provision and therefore didn't have any liability. Yet the safe harbor provision is pretty explicit. It requires 3 things: that the servicer notify the person concerned of the error and take corrective action within 60 days, and do so before written notice by the borrower of the error, and before a suit was commenced. GMACM only fits one provision. It is not entitled to safe harbor because it never discovered the error prior to written receipt from the plaintiffs. It's undisputed that plaintiffs sent a letter in October that was received, on October 14th of 2004 stating payment dispute, which GMACM responded to as payment dispute on the 21st of the same month. In fact, they don't show a single date or even suggest a date when they discover this error on their own. They don't even make the argument they do. They also don't make the argument that they sent notice to the plaintiff as required by the provision. Instead, on page 19 of its response brief, it argues the court must read its provision and enforce the terms and the conjunction and not insert the word or. We agree. They have to comply with every single provision. It should be complied with as and not or. In any event, taking the facts in the light most favorable to plaintiffs, GMACM was notified before they ever discovered the error in writing by plaintiffs by at least October 14th of 2004. And they also notified them again on November 15th and again on December 9th of 2004 in several letters. And GMACM never even argues they notified a plaintiff in writing of the error. They're not entitled to the safe harbor provision. As such, we respectfully submit the trial court erred in finding so. Now, as I stated a moment ago, the trial court never analyzed whether the servicer complied with RESPA. We submit that this issue should be remanded to the trial court to do so rather than this appellate court deal with it as a matter of first impression. To the extent this court is willing to deal with whether the servicer complied with RESPA, we submit they did not. There's a whole variety of letters in the record, focusing on three. The letter received on October 15th of 2004, titled Payment Dispute. That letter stated that RBC made a variety of errors in the loan. It stated how they, from the first payment, was incorrectly applied because RBC imputed the wrong due date. They stated that the monthly amount that RBC was attempting to collect was incorrect. Now, GMAC responded by saying, no, the borrower is wrong. RBC told us so. All the bank had to do was look at the loan documents. They had them. They're going to say that they relied upon the information provided to RBC. It's not reasonable to do so when you're put on notice that RBC made such errors. And when you have the documents, the note, the first payment letter, which supports plaintiff's position. So GMAC failed to take corrective action in response to the October letter. November 15th letter spells out again plaintiff's problems with RBC, requests them to timely apply the payments.
Which letters were sent to GMAC and which were sent to HUD?
The letter dated October 6th, which was received by GMAC on October 14th, was forwarded to HUD. The other letters were sent directly to GMACM.
Would you answer my question? Which letters were sent to GMAC and which were sent to HUD?
The October 6th letter was sent to HUD.
Was sent to HUD. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And forwarded to GMACM. And GMAC responded on October 21st to that letter. And then the November 15th letter was sent directly to GMACM, which included the check for $11,186. And that letter asked to timely apply the payments and set forth the errors in RBC. Then we have several other letters asking them to cash the checks and to timely apply payments. And we have a December 9th 2004 letter explaining the errors with RBC and again asking them to not only cash the prior payments, but to cash the December payment as well. GMACM never argues it complied with RESPA. Didn't do it. They never argued that in trial court. They didn't argue it here. Instead, they say that these letters aren't qualified written requests, so they don't have to comply. And in doing so, they argue that none of these letters seeks corrective action, or which we dispute because they asked to timely apply payments.
Was that issue discussed below? Whether your letters qualified as qualified written requests?
It was briefed. It was never decided in the order, Your Honor. And we submit one new argument on appeal is that these letters only seek information. and seeking information doesn't qualify as a qualified written request. And the statute explicitly states a borrower can seek information in a qualified written request. GMACM relies upon a series of cases, including Moore versus FDIC, where those borrowers sought information other than servicing. And those courts held that when you're seeking information other than servicing, which is the periodic receipt of payments or timely application of payments, those aren't qualified requests. In this case, we don't have that. Plaintiffs were asking, timely apply our payments. That is servicing. So these are all qualified requests. And we suggest that the court is going to entertain that issue. It finds so. Now, turning to the breach of contract, GMACM asserts that it corrected the account. It dismissed the foreclosure. 6 months later, it corrected the credit reports. It fixed its mistakes. Yet, somewhat, we believe, inconsistently argues, plaintiff breached the contract. And in doing so, it focuses on the fact that in October of 2004, plaintiffs were trying to determine who their mortgage servicer was. Their check to RBC was sent back by GMAC. They were writing letters to RBC, they wrote letters to GMACM, and they wrote letters to HUD asking who our mortgage servicer was. And when they found out,
Take one step back. It looks to me like your best argument that GMAC has violated the statute is based on 2605E3, because it made adverse credit reports more than 60 days after receiving some complaint. Do you contend that your clients lost any favorable economic transaction as a result of those credit reports?
Yes, Your Honor. As we set forth in our brief, there's a variety of personal and home loans and business loans that plaintiffs tried acquiring. And taking the LaSalle loan, for example, they applied for a home equity loan at the same time as a foreclosure was pending and the same time as this credit report was ongoing. And this was December of 2004, March of 2005, and February of 2005. And according to the loan officer, the foreclosure on the credit report was one of the concerns the bank had and one of the reasons for denial.
I'm trying to separate out claims based on bad credit reports from claims based on the foreclosure action. Is there any concrete argument that favorable economic transactions were lost because of the credit reports?
Yes, because the LaSalle loans state the credit score was too low. And based upon the debt-to-income ratio and the amount of the debts. And the amount of the debt that was being reported by GMACM was 98% of all plaintiffs' debts. So that directly affected the credit report. So adversely reporting this mortgage as delinquent and accelerated, the total outstanding amount being due, there's direct correlation between the low credit score. And we have the credit report from that time, and if we add up all the debts on the credit report, 98% of the debts is the GMACM mortgage that they were reporting as delinquent. So we submit that the LaSalle loan is a direct economic harm as a result of the credit reporting.
Did the district court ever have that issue? Did it review the issue of damages?
It never got the damages. As with the issue of whether letters fit within the parameters of the Kranz-Gonzalez Amendment, it never reached that because it stopped when it found there's no liability. And we would submit the issue of damages should also be dealt with at the trial court as a matter of first impression.
Was that presented in the summary judgment?
It was.
The issue of damages?
It was.
You just didn't reach it?
Yes.
Okay.
GMACM submitted about 198 facts. The majority of them dealt with damages. And it was fully briefed, but the trial court never reached that decision. Now, turning to the breach of contract claim, the trial court focused on the fact that the October payment was withheld while plaintiffs were trying to figure out who was servicing their loan. We contend that that's a technical default at best, if it is one. But in any event, their own letter dated October 15th stated, if you pay $9,588 within 30 days, you'll cure any default. And they did so. They sent a check in for $11,186. They cured the default that GMACM contended was owed, which wasn't the correct amount because it was based upon a higher monthly payment that was actually owed. So they cured that. And after they cured that, the foreclosure was filed afterwards. It wasn't like they filed a foreclosure first based upon a mistake. They filed a foreclosure after they had funds in hand that would have cured the default. And the recovery reporting didn't start until a month after as well. And that's a breach of the contract. So now GMACM states that there's no time frame to apply payments. The law imposes a reasonable time. And to the extent it does not, the perfect example of why the court should recognize a duty in tort to act reasonably in servicing these loans. Now, as far as the negligence claim, the trial court never examined whether a duty exists. This is being raised for the first time on appeal. It dealt that since GMACM acted promptly in dismissing the foreclosure within 23 days, there's not an issue of whether their actions were willful and wanton. We submit that's a jury question, and it ignores the actions before the foreclosure and ignores the actions after the foreclosure. We contend that there's a claim under negligence even if foreclosure was never filed. Sending back the payments to cure the default and reporting them as delinquent to a credit bureau for 6 months after the fact is negligent, is willful and wanton conduct, even if there wasn't a foreclosure being filed. And I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fleischman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The briefs on this appeal cover a lot of ground, and I'd like to focus on two issues this morning, the safe harbor provision under RESPA and the issue of damages. The district court was correct in its reading of the safe harbor provision because it's consistent with the plain language of that provision and also because a contrary reading would render that provision superfluous. The safe harbor provision of RESPA provides, by its terms, that transferor or transferee servicers have a separate set of rules for these purposes. And when a servicer is involved in a transfer of servicing, then that servicer will not be liable for any failure to comply with any section of RESPA concerning servicer requirements if the error is corrected within 60 days, if the error is corrected before both the receipt of written notice and the commencement of an action by the borrower, and the corrective action is handled in such a way so that the borrower is not made to pay any amount of money that he or she otherwise would have had to pay. The plaintiff's reading of this provision is incorrect because it says that the safe harbor is not available to a transferee servicer immediately upon receipt of written notice by the borrower. That is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute because the statute says that both receipt of written notice and the commencement of an action must occur before the safe harbor is lost. In addition,
it says the safe harbor is available if you correct the error before the commencement of an action under this subsection and the receipt of written notice.
That's correct.
Why doesn't it require that you do that, that you correct the error before either of those events occur?
No, and that's exactly the issue, Judge. The safe harbor provision says that it will be lost if corrective action is not taken before both the commencement of an action and the receipt of written notice. That's
so
a conjunctive.
You would change the and to an or.
No, exactly the opposite. I would leave the and.
You're saying, if I understand you correctly, that if you make the correction before either the commencement of an action or before you receive notice from the borrower, then you're entitled to the safe harbor, right?
That's not the way we're reading it. We're saying that the statutory clause says that corrective action must be taken for safe harbor purposes before both commencement of an action and the receipt of written notice. And that conjunctive is important because without it, the whole safe harbor is superfluous. If a servicer loses the benefit of a of the safe harbor immediately upon receipt of a written notice, then there's really never a case where that safe harbor would apply to a failure to comply with the servicing rules regarding qualified written requests.
Why is that clause in the safe harbor then?
The clause is in the safe harbor because it recognizes that a transferee servicer or a transferor servicer requires some additional time to receive records.
Why is the provision in there that says before the receipt of written notice of the error from the borrower?
Right. It says before both the receipt of written notice from the borrower and the commencement of an action. And that time period provides an extended period of time for a transferee servicer to investigate an account after discovering it. That's the triggering time period for a safe harbor. Upon discovering the error, then some additional time is provided to correct that account so long as the other requirements are satisfied and it's before the commencement of an action.
No, but look, here's my problem with that reading of the statute. That makes the commencement of an action part of the statute surplus, because the commencement of an action is receipt of written notice from the borrower. It's impossible to understand how you could commence an action without notifying the lender that you've commenced the action. You have to serve them with process. So you seem to be saying that in addition, in order to deprive the servicer of the safe harbor, first you have to sue them, and then you have to give them this informal written notice, which is surely surplus if you've sued them. Wouldn't that be a very strange thing to provide?
There is authority, Judge, that says that a...
Forget the authority. Sure. Just give me an answer based on reasons.
Under RESPA, simply the filing of an action is a receipt of written notice for the servicer requirements. There's the written notice is contemplated in terms of a qualified written request. And so
you're not dealing with my problem. Do you think what this is about is that it's dealing with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4M? That is, that you can commence an action without serving process for 120 days, and then the idea is that the servicer's defense isn't cut off until you actually serve process, and that would be the notice?
I don't think that's what this provision is about. I think what this provision is about is about providing some additional time for a transferee servicer upon receipt of written notice. Now, if we take this in the disjunctive and not the conjunctive, if the commencement of an action without prior written notice in itself is sufficient for the safe harbor, that doesn't make any sense because duties under RESPA arise upon the receipt of written notice. If written notice by itself is okay, in the same instance where a servicer receives that written notice, duties arise and the safe harbor is lost.
Don't you also have duties that arise without written notice, obligations to give notice, for example, to the borrowers that their loan has been transferred, and to make orderly arrangements so that the payments are credited to the right servicer?
There are requirements under 2605 that go to a notice of transfer of servicing. The safe harbor provision is not limited to those provisions because for two reasons. One, it very clearly says that that it provides non-liability for any failure to comply with any part of Section 2605. And two, it specifically speaks to taking corrective action in an account in such a way that the borrower is not required to make any payments that they otherwise would not have to make. There's no payments contemplated within a notice of transfer of servicing. And that part of the safe harbor suggests that it goes directly to the qualified written request provisions of 2605E.
Mr. Flashman, if I could ask you, what is GMACM's position as to when it discovered the error?
Our position is that we discovered the error on December 17, 2004, when we first received a letter from the borrower saying, "Stop, I'm disputing this account." Backing up, if we're going to get into the letters, Judge, I would just say that the analysis going letter by letter and seeing whether or not that letter is a qualified written request under RESPA, and if so, whether it's the type of qualified written request that merely requests information or raises a dispute and so on and so forth. That's a complicated analysis. We dispute whether or not there is any RESPA violation here, but my point this morning is that that analysis is not required at all because the plain terms of the safe harbor provision do apply.
Is it your company's position that the date that it discovered the error that by that December 17th, 04 letter is a different date from when it received written notice?
No, that was the date that that the plaintiff sent in a letter saying saying exactly that. We dispute this account. This gave us cause to go back and review this account and understand the nature of the error.
Then why wasn't your receipt of the October 6th letter that you labeled a payment dispute sufficient notice 2 months earlier?
Understood.
Before you filed the foreclosure action.
The HUD letter was an October 6, 2004 letter that the plaintiff sent to HUD that was forwarded to GMAC Mortgage for a response. The reason why that letter did not put GMAC Mortgage on notice that there's a current error in the account is because that letter, by its terms, raised issues with respect to RBC. They said, for example, the stated purpose of that letter, it's a bullet point right up on page one that says, our purpose here is to hold RBC accountable. For its actions. It's to shed light on how RBC operates, and it's to inform others about the ways that deceptive lenders can harm borrowers.
You all recognized it as a payment dispute, right?
We recognize.
At least a jury could find that?
No, I don't think so, Judge, because that part.
After you labeled it payment dispute?
We labeled it payment dispute because it's we copied the Ray line that came from HUD. HUD sent us a letter
saying.
They
say it's a payment dispute, and you don't recognize it, is that?
We don't, and let me tell you why. Our response to that letter gave a comprehensive overview of the account history. We said, this is what we show. We show that, and mind you, this is within a month after the transfer of servicing for safe harbor purposes, but our letter said that we reviewed this account, that the account is due for the May 2004 payment, that there were insufficient funds passed by the borrowers through a check, and that the borrowers have not provided us with any information to rebut that. We said straight up in that letter that the borrowers have never said, here, you misapplied payments, that here there are checks that we made, and here are copies, and these need to be applied correctly. Those are the types of facts that would give GMAC Mortgage cause to say there's a payment dispute here. But according to our records, there was no such cause existed, and so we sent a letter back saying that. We said we've got no reason to believe that a payment a dispute exists based on these records, and we've not received any information to the contrary. So for that reason, the October 6, 2004 letter is not sufficient to put us on notice for safe harbor purposes that there was an error in the account. So the district court ought to be affirmed, again, based on the plain language of the safe harbor provision. It does require both the receipt of written notice and the commencement of an action. A contrary reading would render that provision superfluous, and the district court ought to be affirmed.
If we disagree with you about that safe harbor issue, do you think this court ought to address the RESPA merits, or do you agree with your colleague who suggests that those go to the district court for resolution?
I think that they can be addressed at this level. We have facts in the record and in our brief about every single letter, and I think that you could address it. I would encourage the court to look to these letters, to look at the record, look at our 56.1 statement.
Why? I don't see in your brief any argument that GMAC complied fully with the Act.
We argue in our response.
Certainly understand the proposition that a court of appeals can affirm a district court on any argument properly preserved there, but only if an appropriate argument is made in the briefs. You've argued that the plaintiff didn't sustain any damages under the Act, but I can't see an argument that GMAC complied with the Act. Now, maybe I haven't read your brief right. Where is this argument in your brief?
A duty, it's the part of the brief where I say that none of the letters are qualified written requests that give rise to a duty to take corrective action within 60 days. And I go through those letters in the...
Tell me where this is in your brief.
I could, if you'd like me to go to the brief, I would do that. But as I flip through this, Your Honor, the argument is that if you take a look at these letters, you'll find that in addition to them not being qualified written requests, the type of information that was requested as a result of these letters.
Just tell me where in your brief.
Page 16, subheading D, plaintiff's letters are not qualified written requests.
Although this is part of your argument about the safe harbor.
It is. And the argument is, which is the argument that I think Your Honor is asking about, even if we take a pass on the safe harbor and get into the RESPA compliance, is there a compliance violation here? And our answer to that question is no. And the reason is that there were a series of letters and responses from GMAC Mortgage. These letters, contrary to what the plaintiff is saying, which is why I want you to get into the record and take a look at the letters if you think it's necessary, and see that the letters say, Dear GMAC Mortgage, please tell us the date of the transfer of servicing and the amount due under the loan, and that we timely provided that information over and over and over again. And it wasn't until December of 2004 when the plaintiffs first said, stop, I dispute this account now. And that's when the error was discovered and corrective action was taken within 60 days before both the receipt of written notice and the commencement of an action.
Why wouldn't it be more appropriate to ask the district court to make the findings or to review the record with regard to what these various letters constitute?
Because all of those letters were in the record and they were before the district court and they're also included in the record on appeal. And you can affirm the summary judgment on any ground you want.
But weren't there issues of fact between the parties as to what those letters constitute, how to interpret them in effect?
I don't think that there's an issue of fact as to how they could be interpreted. The letters say what they say, and they're before you. And I don't think there could be an issue of fact that where a letter says, Dear GMAC Mortgage, please tell me how much is due under my mortgage loan, and the plaintiffs come in and argue that, no, that letter actually says, I dispute this account, please apply payments, and there's been a problem. If the letter, just in by its plain terms, doesn't say that, I don't see how there's a question of fact about it. I'd like to also, before my time is up.
Isn't there a question of fact as to whether or not a particular letter constitutes GMAC discovering the problem as opposed to receiving notice from the plaintiffs?
I think that can be resolved as a matter of law. Again, just on the plain.
On what basis?
On the letters. On the letters in the record, Your Honor. If a letter prior to December 17th doesn't say, I dispute this account now, GMAC Mortgage, you are not applying my payments correctly, GMAC Mortgage, I send in payments that are not being applied, and that's wrong. If such a letter exists before December 17th, then that's, it doesn't in the record, and that's why summary judgment is appropriate.
Did the district court find that those letters constituted various discovery trigger or various notice trigger as a matter of law?
The district court did find that the error was discovered in early December because that was the first time that the plaintiff ever disputed payment with GMAC Mortgage. That's in the memorandum opinion.
I'm aware of that, but what was the basis in the record that the district court, as you understand, made the finding of discovery in December? Did he attribute it to a particular letter or particular action?
I believe he, Judge Lindberg, attributed it to the letter that says, quote, we're writing to dispute your attempt to collect this debt.
Which is which letter?
That was December 17th, 2004. Now, damages provides a wholly separate basis for affirmation in this case. The plaintiffs seek two types of damages, statutory damages under RESPA and actual damages. Statutory damages under RESPA are not available here because they require evidence establishing a pattern and practice of noncompliance with the statute. No such evidence exists in this case. I don't believe it's alleged in the complaint. There was no pattern and practice discovery, and there's a complete discovery record before the court here. And there's just absolutely no evidence at all to create an issue as to whether or not there was a pattern and practice of noncompliance with RESPA for statutory damages purposes. With respect to actual damages, there are two categories, credit-based damages and emotional damages. There's a lot of paper on this, and what the record shows is that GMAC Mortgage deposed the banks to which the plaintiff applied for credit. And those banks put forward a witness. We asked them point blank, did GMAC Mortgage have anything to do with your credit decision here? And they said no. They said no. In fact, for LaSalle Bank, which was just referenced by the appellant, GMAC Mortgage at the time of the first credit application wasn't even reporting any derogatory credit information. And for the other loans, the witnesses said very point blank that there were other credit concerns that they had. I don't need to get into them right now, but they're very clearly stated in the record that these loans were declined for other purposes. With respect to emotional damages, this court has held.
Before you move on to that, why isn't, for example, the testimony about the statements of loan officer Reed sufficient to create a genuine issue of fact?
The a statement from the plaintiff about a loan, what a loan officer said, is hearsay. What's better?
Why isn't it the bank's state of mind that the officer is reporting? Here's why we decided.
The bank's testimony under oath is better evidence of that.
It's a good jury argument.
It's not a jury argument. It's the only evidence in the record.
You're saying that the plaintiff can't testify about what the loan officer told her about the bank's reasons?
Not if we've got the bank on the record sitting there saying, here's what the reasons were.
Suppose you don't have the bank. This is before you take their deposition. Are you saying that the plaintiff's testimony about what the loan officer said about the bank's reasons is inadmissible hearsay?
It is an inadmissible hearsay.
I'm sorry?
It is an inadmissible hearsay.
Why isn't it just state of mind?
It's a statement from, it's an out-of-court statement. So my position would be that it's hearsay, but the facts of this case is that the bank is on the record testifying as to the purpose for its credit decision.
Now that can be relevant. Either the plaintiff's statement is hearsay or it isn't. The fact that there's contrary evidence from the bank just creates a material dispute.
Your Honor, the bank took the oath and testified as to exactly what made its credit, what determined its credit decision. And in this case, again, the record is that LaSalle Bank declined a credit application at the time when GMAC Mortgage was not reporting any derogatory credit information. So with respect to the first credit application. I see I'm out of time. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll...
Yep, thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Keough?
One thing you did not hear was what date the bank discovered the error on its own. We're arguing about what date plaintiff notified the bank of the error, whether it's the letter dated October 6th, which states the monthly payment is incorrect, our first payment was due in August of 2003. The one that they respond to is a payment dispute, and they just stated they investigated, they looked at the payments, and found out there was some issues with insufficient funds, they argued. They investigated a payment dispute. They disagreed with plaintiff's points, but they investigated a payment dispute in October of 2004. And their corporate representative testified they were on notice from the December 9th, 2004 letter. It's really immaterial on when they're put on notice for purposes of the safe harbor, because whether it is the October date or any of the December dates, they are notified by plaintiffs of the error. There is not a single date or argument regarding when they discovered the error by themselves. We submit the and/or issue, I think, has been fairly dealt with here. The and conjunctive requires them to comply with all provisions, not one out of three. The damage argument is credibility. Who has a better claim before the jury is what the issue will be. Not only do we have plaintiff's testimony, we have documents from the banks. They took certain positions under oath. They also have letters saying foreclosure is an issue. Credit score is an issue when the 98% of the credit score is affected by the foreclosure. We have arguments to make to the jury as well. And the LaSalle loan, both the February and March application, GMACM was reporting to the bureaus. For December 1, the foreclosure was on the report. So the foreclosure was also on the report because it was filed in November.
Was it the earlier RBC foreclosure month or the GMAC foreclosure?
The GMACM foreclosure. So we contend that it is not entitled to the safe harbor provision, that the trial court should examine these issues of whether GMACM complied or did not comply with RESPA, that plaintiffs did not breach the contract, and if there was a technical default, that was cured when they sent a check in for $11,186, which is more than they asked for. We contend that GMACM's actions were not so prompt as a matter of law to rule in their favor for summary judgment on the negligence, willful, and wanton claim, because that only focuses on when they dismissed the foreclosure. The trial court did not look at their actions beforehand, when they were first notified in September of 2004 of this payment dispute, and until May of 2005, when they finally corrected the credit reporting. And also, the court didn't examine that they didn't reinstate the loan or waive any fees until HUD directed them. This is not GMACM doing this by themselves. HUD directed them to fix the credit report. HUD directed it to waive the late fees and reinstate the loan. It did so. And for those reasons, we respectfully submit the trial court erred in granting summary judgment to the GMACM. Thank you for your consideration today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is